With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, my name is Ben Stewart and welcome to episode number 3 of the Create More podcast. On this fortnight's podcast, I sit down with Jay Ann, who is, along with Marie Smith, one of the founding members of Studio Weave. I've been a really long time fan of Studio Weave, and primarily I love their website, and a lot of their projects that pop up on DZine and things are just, they're just absolutely stunning. They just kind of capture your attention straight away. And in particular, I don't know if you've seen, but we go over it a bit in the podcast, but their Lullaby Factory, which is like a fantastic, I guess, audio installation at a hospital. And also they did a project called The Longest Bench, which is a really, really nice community-based project where they, we go into it in the podcast again, and I'll put up images through Acast and things, but check it out. It's really cool. It's like a, I think it's 250 to 300 meter long bench, and each slat on the bench, you can pay money and you can dedicate the slats on those bench to whoever you want. And then we go over, and it's just a really, really nice project. And their website, if you check it out, studioweave.com, is a really, really nice, very story-driven website. And I really wanted to find out more. And in episode 1 with Assemble Studios, where I sat down with Jane, I actually found out when I was talking about who I liked. I found out she actually worked for Studio Weave, and she put me in touch with Jay, and that was really nice. And then I got in contact with her, and Jay was, we went around his studio and we sat down, and it was really, really good fun. So this is episode number 3 of the Create More podcast, and I hope you've gone back and listened to episode 1 with Assemble Studios, and also I hope you enjoyed episode 2 with David Batchelor. This has been really good fun. We've got hundreds of downloads now. I mean, I don't think that's in a small part because of a certain Mr. Scroobius Pip tweeting this podcast, and definitely had quite a spike on the day that happened. But it's going really, really well. So I really hope you enjoy the podcast. And at the end of the podcast, I'll let you know who I'm going to sit down with tomorrow, actually, when I record this. I'm really excited about it. It's another installation architect, and I really want to tell you about it. So listen in the end, and I'll tell you all about it. Just before we get into the podcast, I do want to thank Acast. They've been brilliant, and their website is amazing. And I think special mention should go to Renee, their content manager, who has been so helpful, and also to the very patient Gustav, who's is their technical support and has been dealing with my late night moanings and explaining to me how to work what is a very simple website. So thank you to Acast for supporting this and hosting this podcast, because it's all automated. There's images, there's videos. It's all free for you guys, and it pops up on iTunes, and everything about the website is brilliant. So I really hope you enjoy the podcast and listen into the end to see who's next on next week. Yeah, that's it. I'm recording now. So, as I said, there's no introduction. It's just a very free-form chat. But I'm here with Jay from Studio Weave. So thank you very much for inviting me over to studio.
Thank you for coming all the way to Dalston.
Yeah, it's another great studio. As I was saying to you before, it was it's been really great to go into other people's studios and see how the setup works. I do think people's studios directly resemble how they work and operate. Like going into Assemble Studios, it was, you're in the middle of a big warehouse, and then I went to David Batchelor's studio, and it's very clean and pristine and wonderful, and there's arts everywhere. And it's really nice seeing all of you in one room.
Yeah.
Which I guess adds, I think it's important to have everyone very close together and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, we're really chatty people, so, you know, it's, I find it quite weird when there is silence in office.
Yeah.
That means something is up in the air, so I get quite agitated. But no, I mean, yeah, we're thinking of actually moving to a bigger open warehouse space.
Oh, really?
Because, I mean, when we moved here first time, we were 4 of us. Was it, or were we 5 of us? And then now we are, we're 9 of us. So, yeah, we want a bit more space to do stuff,
yeah.
Really.
So I guess I had lots of questions. I was going to start from the beginning, but I wanted to talk to you about your on your website. It says big news, we're merging with 00, but it's not merging. You're collaborating.
We're joining forces. It's you know, the UMet Assemble and how we how they operate. I mean, I've been knowing them since right from the beginning almost. And had a lot of chat how they work, and just nature of how we work and how we share information and how we form teams within office and with a wider a consultants is changing quite a lot. It's not really hierarchical output, so it was becoming somewhere in between collective, but you know, the each other knowing each other's ability, and started to form a team in the surrounding projects.
So why 00? Did you know them through friends?
Oh yeah. We've been known them for a long time. I mean, it's a small world, but I'm very, very good friends with them.
Did you go to uni, or do they work locally? Or?
Oh, I'm sorry about that. maybe what I could do is...
Can I answer it?
No. Just gonna silence it. And perhaps what I do is put that in the other room, if you don't mind.
That's fine. Where were we? So we were 00. Why 00? Yeah. How'd you get to know them?
So,
you can get that. There you go. It's fine. So 00.
Yeah. So I don't know what really defines, I mean, we have traditional models of how companies work and how architects' offices work, and it just didn't seem, well, I don't know exactly how they work, to be honest, but we just wanted to find our own way of working. So 00 has grown into quite a different eclectic of architect, non-architect, you know, combo of... multiple companies are working for built environment policies and furniture making.
So they're involved in loads of different. I'll have to look into 00.
Yeah. And you know, we've known them since almost right from the beginning. So
are they a similar scale to you guys, or are they?
Oh no. I think their architecture, just core architecture group, might be about similar size. But overall, if you count all their, you know, under Project 00, probably about, I don't know, 50 to 70.
Wow. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Because there are like subsidiaries, there are a lot of people collaboratively working, and they're sharing resources and their talents. And they make team for the projects, and each subsidiaries and their endeavor is a project.
That's quite clever, isn't it?
I think it just naturally happened. And, I mean, myself and Maria has been thinking about this right from the beginning, when we were looking for a name. Well, it's not like we wanted to actually have a practice. We had to have a practice name and limited company in order to have insurance to do a project.
It's funny that you were saying you didn't start out to be a practice. You just kind of had to form a limited liability company to get... Because it was the same with Assemble. When I asked them... They were like, no, I think we're just a large group of people who are in the same space trying to do the same thing at the same time. And the only reason we formed Assemble was so we could get money, you know, like from the Arts Commission. I don't know, it's a totally different way of thinking. I'd never really thought of it like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an interesting way to look at it. Only way I could possibly describe is we're not really career or capital driven people, but we're mission driven people. And a mission comes with the projects. And in order to deliver the project, you need some kind of support mechanism. And for us, that's the company, which is just a backbone to support individuals' endeavor. And we happen to share core values together. And yeah,
it's funny. It's my because the kind of the basis for this podcast was the idea of starting your own practice. It sounds like when you're at uni, you're like, oh, wouldn't it be great to start your own practice? And me and my friend Tom, this was always our dream, right? Start our own practice. And then we went out into industry and we realized, oh, it's so complicated to get clients and keep the momentum going. And just it's funny to hear you saying we're not corporate driven people. We're like, you know, we're there to create something, and we will make money because of that. But that's not our primary goal, because that would drive my friend Tom mad. He's mm-hmm. he's like, no, you need to understand what the value is that you're achieving, and then stick to a fee and stuff. And it's the reason I was drawn to your website was because the website's amazing. Like it looks so nice. Like I don't know, do you guys develop that in house?
I mean, we are very good friends with Polymechanos, Joseph Kohlmeier, who I sing in a choir together. It's Muzark, based in London Met. I was a founding member. He's a founding director. I used to be director for the Muzark for a while and treasurer. I mean, very good personal friends. And the project... Again, it's a project.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've been collaborating on making website.
It's such a beautiful website. And again, I liked it because in all of your pictures, you've got people using it, interacting with it, and they're all, you've got a lot of story-driven stuff as well, which I don't think is particularly...
Yeah, and I mean, I find that quite interesting that how people say it's a story-driven, because for me... how we understand the world is through narrative and story.
I totally agree. Yeah.
You know, and what's the purpose of built environment if no one's in it?
Yeah. I always find it weird that I know that architects love images with nobody in them. Like I do get that. But then at the same time, no one is ever going to see, especially big buildings, no one's ever going to see them with no one in.
Well, I mean, if you're an architect, just going in once there's a fit out finished.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, I think it's not the reacting against that. It's that is a style of photographing something and representing certain idea.
Yeah.
Then you apply your imagination with the people in it.
Mm.
You know. So I don't know. It's not something either or. But you know, that's what we like is when people are there and. Mm. It's being alive and it's colourful and it's lively and
that's what I really, really like. I think that's great. And a lot of your, you've got a lot of community based architecture projects, and you've done it's like a studio in the woods, and I can't remember the actual name of it, but in all the images you've got lots of children playing, you've got like the bird watchers in it, and I guess the original concept is always that, but you've made sure that you can see that from start to finish. And that, I mean, that was a
just they happen to be in the photograph because you know,
get out the photograph, get out the photograph. Oh, stay in the photograph.
Yeah. No, it's just, you know, the we just have a lot of stakeholder participation. And you know, one of the thing that we believe is the built environment. And what we do as a everyday, it just involves a lot of people.
Yeah.
And we are placing something in a world that other people will be using. So why not involve them?
Yeah.
We don't ask them to design something for us.
No, that's true.
You know, we're not asking them, these are our options, can you pick for us? We just talk to them and... it's just a part of the design process, I guess.
But your website has... It's got like a dual scroll function now. So on the kind of left hand side, you've got all the really, really nice architectural images, and on the right, you've got the kind of the whole process and the story behind it. And for me, modern, like the way that we engage with architecture is 99% through websites, right? You know, like fair enough, if you go to some of the buildings, you see them, that's great, and you can go around them. But most of the time, you see it on DZine, you think, oh, it's a great project, you go on their website, and all of the way that you engage with that practice is through the website, right? And and yours is so interesting and engaging just to scroll through and see everything. And I think for architects, it's fantastic. And I was wondering, do a lot of your clients go to the website and think that's fantastic? Or do you hear feedback from them? Or
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know how our client find us. We haven't had a private client. A lot of our work is through public tender. We now have very few independent commercial clients. We work a lot with charities, but I don't know whether they look at our website. To be honest, it's just out there. That's just kind of like
Do you enjoy feeding into the website? As you said, it's another project, right? So like, yeah. you're very passionate about the work. Is it exactly how you want it? This is, you know, you constantly feed all the projects in, you show it off and stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a sort of a record archive of our process as well. And I mean, yeah. I often go to our website just to read through the project. It's like, oh, that's what we did. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously recorded in several different ways, but it's the way to communicate it in another different medium. Mm.
Especially the temporary nature of a lot of your projects, right? They may not be there in a couple of years' time, and you have to.
Yeah, and I mean, now we're doing a lot of, far bigger projects, which is going to take a lot longer, but shorter, temporary, ish, driven projects happen to finish earlier.
Yeah, I can imagine. I guess the turnaround of the smaller projects is such a night. You must do, I guess you can do four in a year, no problem, and then the big projects take years to do. Yeah.
But it's, the attention goes in, it's not much different. It's a small project, a quick firing, tight budget, fixed program. They are exhausting.
Mm.
They are hard to deliver.
Because the amount of effort that you have to go in, you've just got this big image of the lullaby factory behind you, which is one of the reasons I originally wanted to interview you guys. Was I was chatting to Jane from Assemble. Yeah. And I was like, do you know, one of the studios I really want to interview, Studio Weave, because have you seen the lullaby project they did? And she was like, yeah, I worked there and I worked on that project.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, well. But again, it's a small project, but it must have been so complicated.
Oh, that project was a complicated project. It's just the sheer number of practicalities. Yeah. And you understand, you're an architect.
Yeah, no, I think I was, because I know some of the people that listen to this are part ones, you know, still at uni.
Yeah.
And why don't you explain what the Lullaby Factory is? Because you'll explain it a lot better than me.
Oh, well, I guess it's one of the strangest projects we've done. So Great Ormond Street Hospital is in Holborn. In London, they have this this complex of a site that they're continually redeveloping building by building, because, you know, when they finish the last building, one building they've refurbished, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, is coming to the end of his life and things like that. And a new building, Morgan Stanley Building, I believe that's the name, is facing this Victorian service wall of an old hospital block, but is designed to be overlooking this nice open public space, which is not going to be there for quite a while because there is a building there. So the project came about. Client wanted to make this space more lively or enhance.
Was it a competition?
Yeah, that was invited to competition, and we were like, okay, this is not about the project less is more. This is definitely one of those projects, more is more. Loads of pipes, loads of services. What are they all doing? And no one really knew exactly what they do, because you know how the services get added on to the back of the house and no one knows which pipe goes where in the end, because record is obviously completely lost. So we're like, oh, that's great. We're going to have more of it. we just imagined and we dreamt with a lot of glasses of wine, and this is a factory that produces lullabies. That's kind of all began, and then it just having that concept and just unfolding what the lullaby factory might be and and what kind of ingredient you will need. I'm fascinated by this manufacturing process. It's very beautiful, very functional, yet the complex nature of the design methodology and the logic, it's just great. So,
and the idea is at the base that you can listen in, right? Like it's just bringing sounds and stuff in. Like how the hell do you tune these massive pipes? Do they just randomly make noise, or are they tuned specifically?
Oh no, this is a folly. The whole thing is a narrative driven, story driven, that human not meant to be able to listen, especially while you're awake. It's very, you know, it's split second just before you fall asleep, you hear lullabies. But the obviously the installation itself doesn't make any sound. We worked with Jessica Curry, who is a composer that composed the first iteration of the lullaby, and that's broadcasted through in-house patient FM, and also you can hear it from the few trumpets at the balcony. but no, this is not meant to be actually producing a sound, catching the wind or anything like that.
You know. Oh, but because in one of the images you've got someone stood at the bottom on the balcony listening up. So those things actually
Have a sound coming out,
and that's done by a composer who's done. So nice, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we're hoping basically that the whole premise was this lullabies in a loop, so 24/7, it never stops, and there will be another composer adding on that. At this growing library of loopable lullabies. That was the idea. So
sounds again mind blown. That just sounds like such a nice project to be involved with, right? And then did you then get more work? Because the hospital is like a massive. Once you get on their framework, I guess, and they must have lots of installations and stuff they're doing, or is it not quite as simple as that?
No, I don't think it's as simple as that. It's not the question of a sector. And again, you know, as I said, I don't know how our client finds us. It's not like we do adverts or, you know, aggressively go out parties and try to prod clients.
I guess from the business side, I'm just trying to... I don't know how a small practice gets more work in. You see, this is kind of part of my exploration of interviewing like these smaller practices and stuff. Because how did Studio We first start then? If we go right back to the beginning, was it just you and Marie just like, do you know what, we're just going to go and do some projects?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't even that. I mean, before we went after a year out. This was in the middle of our part one. We just went to a workshop for London Architecture Biennale, at that time it was called, now called London Festival of Architecture. This was 2005, to have a workshop in view of doing an installation for London Architecture Biennale 2006. It was just weekend. We thought it might be fun before we go back to university. We made a proposal and somehow we managed muddled through sponsorships and things and happened.
Just as simple as that. That's how you got your first. So what was the very first project that you guys did?
It was 140 boomerangs. It was a CNC cut LVL timber product, and it's wrapping around this a disused fountain, the water fountain in the city of London, on just south side of a Smithfield market, at the mid market. And we wrote a story narrative about Ulla, who's a goddess, and this the fountain is a secret gate to the underworld. And we had workshops with children imagining creatures and things. It was an exhibition of those clay models and things like that. One of the sponsorship we've got was from City of London, who actually purchased the 50% of the project, because we didn't want to make a project that will be just destroyed after the Biennale Festival itself. So they became urban furnitures. They were reassembled and they were disseminated. So that's how we got the funding together, and with the support of London Metropolitan University, we were able to do that as our final year project.
So you actually wrapped like a live project into your university?
Yeah.
Oh, see, again, that makes so much sense to me. I was saying to Jane that these kind of projects seem like the perfect things to do for your part two.
That was a part one.
Part one.
I wouldn't say it's a part two worthy project because it's not complex enough.
Okay.
But I, I don't know. I mean, it's just a different way of achieving the goal of education. Mm. And, you know, not everyone goes through the same path. But, you know, I say to a lot of people, if you want a certain way and that works for you, then ask.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of being told no.
I just think that doing your part two, you go back and you do, you can do whatever you want, you make these works of art, but then you go into the real world and every single little thing that you do is based on time and money, or money. And the one thing they never, ever, ever get you to do at uni is ever think about money.
I disagree that everything is about money. I would say everything is about value.
Mm.
And where you place their value, whether that's monetary value or your self-satisfaction or your mission, or, you know, the value comes in lots of different shapes and forms.
I mean, instead of money, budget, I think I was meant. So I love the idea that you do a live project that has a budget, has a client,
yeah,
has a time frame, coupled with all the pragmatic, theoretical part of doing an architecture project. That, to me... I still love doing my part one and part two, but it would have seemed like a more logical step up from doing a part one, don't worry about budget, time and money and client, and then for your part two, engaging in something, you know, more complicated, but that still has some live output at the end. And I know a lot of the model, some of the universities have, I guess they put shows on where they have to build stuff, and I think that makes more sense to me, that you have to, there has to be like a physical output as opposed to all digital.
Well, I don't know. I think architecture itself is such a broad discipline. Yeah, I don't think I can say one way is right or another is wrong, really. I think as an individual, as a citizen, who is contributing to the built environment, that we need to be interested in really broad, you know, the area of things. In the same manner, I think, you know, that the students in architecture should be very attuned to the politics and economic theories and sociology and psychology and philosophy and geology, chemistry. I mean, we'd have to have broad interest, but we don't have to be specialists in every single one of them.
Yeah.
I think the problem I see is that when you can't translate your academic understanding and the skills that you have developed into a reality. Because in academia, you can dream and you can fantasize and you can develop to the nth degree without certain, I wouldn't even call it restrictions. It's a different set of parameter.
Yeah.
And then you come out, and you apply those ideas and think about how you can translate it. I mean, as an architect, as a profession, as an architect, how I see myself is translating between a lot of different disciplines.
Mm.
And from dreams to, you know, plumbings to politics to, I don't know, you know,
That's a really good point. Now, I realize I sound overly negative of my part one and part two. I loved them, and it allowed me so much time to develop what I now fully fall back on in any design meeting, which is the things that I really love and I know I like. And first and second year, I just didn't know what that was. And then third year, I had a great tutor called Nicola Gerber, who kind of just pushed me in the right direction. And since then, I've always explored my own thing. So I feel like I'm being very negative.
No. I don't think you are. It's just I think, you know, a lot of people. I mean, obviously, education is a big issue.
Mm.
How do we educate the future architects? I mean, that itself, I find it quite weird. Why do we need to educate future architects? We are educating people of built environment and architecture. So it's, I don't know, the discipline, it's quite a the weird state at the moment, that we're trying to find ourselves as a architectural profession and what word architects mean and all that kind of stuff. But I guess my point is that a lot of people put emphasis on institutions, that what institution is doing wrong, But I sometimes find questioning back to students, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I mean, what are your interests? Are you thinking or are you just going with the flow?
Yeah. So I think I've just suddenly realized the thing that I liked about you having a live project is that actual people who are nothing to do with the uni get to enjoy your thesis project, right?
Mm.
So, and that was when I saw Assemble's kind of earlier projects, and it was just full of people. And this idea that, you know, I spent years doing this architecture work, and then only maybe my other students and some like three tutors saw it, and then it's never been seen again. Mm. And I think I want people to experience it, you know, like, and that's why I liked, you know, the idea that you had a live project that people can go and.
Yeah, but you learned from it.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And you and.
I realize I'm hating on it again, and I don't mean.
No. All I'm saying is, if your passion is to learn through live project, pursue it.
Mm.
If your idea of architecture is exploring to the nth degree of a theoretical backbone and what something might be, because we need dreamers and we need practical ones. And as long as they talk to each other and understand each other, that's perfectly fine.
That's a really good shout. If there's any part ones listening, they need to find out what their strengths are and couple up with some other people who have opposite strengths and form a little unit.
No, I mean, it's just as simple as that. It's like, you know, we have mathematicians who digs in the pure a world of mathematics that not many people in the world will understand. And we have artists, you know, that digging into their own self-belief in a lot of different way. I think we need all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't really thought of it like that. So I'm going back to your first project. So then the next project, did you and Marie just think, do you know what? I think we can do this. Or did you just move down to London and it slowly evolved?
Well, after the 140 Boomerang project, we're like, okay, we graduated. I guess we will do part two. But you know, we were asked by City of London to look at a small bit of a public space as a feasibility study, and we were asked by a group of entrepreneurs led by Jane Wood, who commissioned Heatherwick Studio for the East Beach Cafe down in Littlehampton, just have a look at their promenade and placing some benches. That was how everything just began, and then the ambition grew, and there was, I mean, we're incredibly lucky to be supported and be part of extraordinary journey of other people.
This is the
longest bench.
Is it the longest bench in the UK or the world?
Well, it's designed to be 628 meters, something like that. At the moment,
that's a long bench.
Yeah, 300 odd meters has been delivered. It's definitely the longest in UK.
Wow.
But you know, the longest bench in the world is a very contentious territory.
You should just go for it until someone proves you otherwise. I think you should just say longest bench in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a very, very long bench.
Because I was watching a talk you did for Hackney Design Weekend, and
what did I say?
No, you were great. You were fine. You really did a lovely talk about. What was it? It's for her birthday, 30th, and there was some pigs being slaughtered. I'm paraphrasing massively. There was some sort of tradition when she went home.
Oh no! I think you got too confused.
Yeah.
The Maria's 30th birthday was basically sweatshop party.
That was it. Yeah. So yeah, and there was a tradition.
Yeah.
And
so many friends were invited to this. East London warehouse, starting from noon till midnight, making a quilt.
But that just sounds like torture. So you just have to sew for an entire day.
Basically, sew and chat, eat, and slowly getting drunk, and yeah, it was quite a beautiful day.
Well, I should say as well that I host this podcast on Acast, which is like a hosting website, but you can embed images into the podcast. So if you listen to it on your phone or anything, as we're talking, I'll pop up images that on your phone and also links. So I'll link the DZine chat so people can understand why I'm massively paraphrasing and getting two things mixed up. But in that talk, you were saying that the bench continues in length because people can donate and then they can write a note on the actual pieces of wood that form the slats of the bench, right? And people have put marriage proposals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had a couple of marriage proposals on our project. Freya's Cabin. Up in Northumberland, we've got a really nice email from, I guess, a fiancé, probably married now, and I mean, this is years back, that he took his girlfriend up there, and he proposed to her on the spot with a sunset, and she's this juror, a jewelry designer, and she want to make an engagement ring with the little Freya's Cabin on the top. So, you know, we gave them 3D models and we had a nice little chat over email. A longest bench was used as a proposal as well.
That's so nice, isn't it?
I think it's that's great.
It's all part of the story of, of your bigger projects. Yeah. So then I'm just fascinated how these studios start. I think I'm trying to work out, this is like an instruction list on how a small studio can start and become a studio as big as yours. And you got your second project, The Longest Bench. And then when did you decide, okay, because it was just you and Marie, right, this time. When do we, we're going to take the next step. We're going to get a studio space, or we're going to employ a few more people, or was it just...
Yeah, I mean, we were just two of us for first about... first about 2 years, and this is actually our first outside of our living room studio space.
So that's how you first started. It was at your house, was it?
Because it wasn't, we weren't doing it to start a studio.
Mm.
We were doing it because there were projects, and it just happened to be, you have to have a certain setup to do a project. You know, you receive a contract from City of London, you read it through and what kind of liabilities you have and, you know, the insurance requirements and, you know, you just go with it.
So how many people did you have at your house then? There's actually people working at your house.
Maximum, I think, by the time we had five people in the living room,
really?
We were like, that's it. That's it. We're moving out.
Because I think as well, I'm starting to get a very, in the question in my head, how do you start your own studio? Just really hard work and being super passionate. I think that seems strikingly obvious, but...
Why would you want to?
I was going to ask you that. Yeah, what was the decision? Did you ever think, do you know what? We've done this now, I'm going to move to a bigger practice? Or was it always, I want to control and have personal, not control, but just freedom to explore and do whatever you want? Or was Studio Weave
you never really have a true freedom. I mean, this is John Stuart Mill all over again, but you know, it's like a freedom from and, you know, freedom to, all that kind of argument. But you know, what is the freedom in the architectural world? Mm. Yes, as I was saying, you know, you can dream as much as you want, but as soon as you have to apply to the real world, you have to consider other people.
Oh, other people. It's getting in the way, aren't they?
No, that's the best part. That's the best part. The best thing about, you know, the studio is I am interested in organization at the same time in a built environment.
Mm.
It's about people and how we apply ourselves in the society, and it's all about human endeavor, and I find it fascinating, and I want to nurture and encourage people to do what they're passionate about.
Mm.
You know, and that's my passion, to build a framework and the basis to let people thrive.
Yeah.
You know, and if I can do that personally, whether it's a Studio Weave or big other practices, it doesn't really matter, because what matters are the people
there.
So you know, it's just the working with the 00 is kind of same thing. Studio Weave has its mission as a studio, and what we do is often perceived as a slightly quirky and different, but it's because people are driven in a certain direction. That doesn't mean we're not interested in other things, but you know, that this is the direction we are at the moment. So it's not about having control. Yes, I like well-built things and, you know, well-thought-out things, but I believe in multiplicity of human society. We are different. All should be respecting each other of the differences. The one of the reason I became British, and there's something I love about this country, is we are encouraged to be who we are.
I totally agree, yeah.
You know, and why don't we do that with all other institutions? Why are we worried about the corporate culture? As long as they can be different and flexible, and it's about people. Often they're not. I can completely see that, but you know, it's but if you want to change it, change it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing though, isn't it? If you don't agree with something, then do something different yourself. I think it's just taking that first leap and that first step, I guess. Yeah. I mean, your first project, just you went out and you got a project, and then you've just built on that, and I guess the momentum's just been there. Is there been points where you've not had work in, and you've just, and you've thought, well, okay, let's have a hiatus for a bit, we've not got any work in, or have you always just through, you know, hard work or luck or networking, just constantly had a kind of slow or steady?
Business is hard.
Yeah.
It's a harsh world out there. You know, the earning is an issue. Living in London is an issue.
Yeah.
Finding somewhere that you can afford is an issue. But, you know, you counterbalance that with the joy that you get out from people and the project.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and you move forward. I don't know. I don't retain negative memories very well.
I totally agree with you. Yeah. If it's negative, it falls out my memory completely.
Yeah, it's but it's hard. It's yeah. hard. And sometimes you get really depressed looking at the reality in a negative turn. But you know, you tell yourself off. You pick yourself up,
have a few G&Ts, and then
yeah, exactly,
back in the game.
Exactly. Yeah, I was filling in patient data update yesterday in dentist, and they were asking, so your average consumption of alcohol per week in units. I was like, whoa.
They might as well shine a detective light in your face, and you're like, I had the exact same thing, and they were like, I was like, what's the most you're allowed in a week? And they were like, 9 units. And I was like,
yeah, then forget
I drink
that.
9 units? And they just wrote down 9. I'm like, who drinks 9 units in a week?
That's 4.5 pints.
In a week?
In a week.
Yeah.
4.5 pints.
That's just a Thursday night.
Well, yeah, exactly. That is exactly what I said. I'm like, that's ridiculous.
And when they go, that's a week, right? And you're like, yes. Sure, why not? Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah.
But then, I guess like you need a healthy intake of alcohol just to get out of your head for a bit, right? I mean,
it's, I don't know. I sometimes enjoy non-alcoholic beer. A rare occasion.
Yeah, yeah.
Rare occasion.
For breakfast,
but,
sure.
You know. But you know,
I guess it's keeping the momentum up of a practice, right? Because when it's just you and Marie, when you've got the projects in, great. When you don't, you know, there's other things. But then once you start building up the employee number, you're like, oh god, we've got a, it's a thing now. I've got to keep it going. And then
it's stressful.
Yeah, I think
it's stressful.
Just in a like a tiny little way, and in no way do I think this is it anyway, but doing the podcast, and I said I was going to do one every 2 weeks, and I was like, how hard can that be? It's always in the back of my head now, because you know, I need to get another one, and that's just a podcast. It's just like a passion project for me. So when you've actually got to get projects in and stuff, and
it's a pressure. Yeah, it definitely is.
Because I'm going down what is art and what is architecture route with this question. Because
I'm looking forward for it.
Yeah, because I was cycling around near the Gherkin stuff, and I saw, I can't remember the name of it now, it's embarrassing. It's the, I'm going to describe it really poorly. You've got a wonderful floating timber sculpture.
Oh, you mean at Aldgate?
Yes, yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's the
Palace upon Pillar.
Palace on Pillar, that's the one I was looking for. To me, that's art, right? But I guess you would call yourselves an architecture studio, but you don't call yourself an architecture studio.
No.
But your output, I feel it's like it's art and architecture, right? Like it's this is what I was having this conversation. When is art architecture? And I jokingly said, well, all the time. But it was just weird. To me, that's art, right? Like it's a sculpture, and some of the Lullaby Factory. That's art, not architecture. But then you're building into bigger projects which are architecture, and I was wondering, do people ever bring these up?
Oh, all the time. And my answer is, I don't know.
It is what it is.
I mean,
right?
It's the category. This categorization, what is art and what's architecture? I mean, I don't know. If someone tell me exactly what their categorization of what art is, what architecture is, then I probably can tell them which side it might fall into. But theoretically, it can be either or.
Yeah.
Really. Some people might it incredibly functional and useful, because personally, I think aesthetic and its presence has a functional a functional output to the society, and some people might not. So
you never argue for and against. If someone wants to call it art, great. If someone wants to call it architecture, you're just like, done.
Yeah. Well, they often come with a different form of contract.
Because I was wondering, you have to self-promote yourself, and I know personally that I'm terrible at that. You know, like bigging yourself up, I hate it. Like, it's not something I like doing, but as a practice, you have to do that, right? You have to. And I was wondering, when you're going for pitching for more work, different sectors, so say, you know, I would say the Lullaby Factory is a kind of art installation as much as anything. Do you pitch your work as art to other clients, potential clients? You look, we've got this background of artwork, and you pitch these things, or?
No, we generally just talk about what we are passionate about and how we would like to do things, not about what project is art or what, you know. I don't know. I mean, we are fairly British about things. Shouting out top of our lung in a way, then I go, we are fucking amazing. It's not really in our nature, you know.
Yeah.
It's like on our Twitter account, it says the word awesome practice, doing awesome project everywhere. And when we that was just our friend's joke when we were just doing a tagline of silly stuff. But
I really like that though. Yeah, we're just like, damn straight, doing awesome projects.
No, but that's like a tongue in cheek, isn't it? It's like taking piss out of ourselves. And some people take it really seriously. Oh, they think they're doing an awesome project. Like, oh, well, it's quite funny.
Yeah. I didn't read that as like, wow, they think a lot of themselves, don't they? Awesome. I'm glad you brought that. Do you use social media a lot? I keep wanting to bring this up with Assemble and with Dave Batchelor. Like, is social media important to you guys? Like, because I feel old now, but I don't get why people are on Twitter.
Twitter
is. If you're just a single individual putting images of what you've eaten or something, I don't understand Twitter. But if you're running a practice, what as like a Facebook and LinkedIn, I think Twitter's great. You know, like, you want to build momentum for a show you're putting on, or, you know, an exhibition.
But is there?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Is there? Like,
I don't know.
Do people go, do you know what? I heard you put on Twitter that you're having an exhibition, so I came along. I don't know if, like...
I guess that happens.
Yeah. But you use it, right? Because you put updates and things and... Do you see it as it's important to have a presence? You know, if people type in Studio Weave, you pop up on Twitter, you pop up on websites.
Yeah, it's just being there, yes. Yeah. I mean, we don't really think about that very much. It just happened to be, if someone, I mean, we set up Twitter account and everyone in our office can post it whenever want it. I use my personal Twitter account as my almost like Facebook status update part. I find Facebook quite useful because my friends are all over the world and, you know, to keep it connected and keep my email inbox rather clean.
Yeah.
So it's kind of consolidating what you're doing, you know. The importance of it, yes, I think there is huge value in terms of bringing together society in a way that it does. The same as like what invention of internet did, what telephone did, what mobile phone did. You know, it's just the dissemination of information and how we position ourselves in the world.
Yeah. Because I do understand Twitter's enormous. Twitter's massive and Instagram is huge and Facebook's huge. I guess, I don't know, like from a singular person, you're like, what am I getting out of this? Like, it's interesting and I'm addicted to just, it annoys the hell out of me. On Facebook, I'm just scrolling and then I sometimes delete the app and I'm like, I'm not going to go on it. And then within a day, I crawl back to Facebook and I'm on it again. And I'm like, why? Why do I do it to myself?
Because we don't want to be alone. There are things out there and sometimes it seems like we feel very lonely and siloed. And if you're on Facebook and, you know, people are there.
Mm.
I mean,
that must be one of the great things about having your studio with everyone in the same room.
Yeah, I love them.
Yeah.
I love them.
It must be great, you know, like, what a team, right? And then, do you know what? We're going to finish now and we're just going to have some drinks and then actually probably chat about stuff. Design ideas fly around just as much as they do.
I mean, we drink while we work.
Awesome.
5 o'clock in the afternoon, gin and tonic. I mean, it's... we don't really separate the work life and personal life in a very clear-cut manner. Mm. I think you can be professional and have fun.
Yeah.
And you got to enjoy what you do, right? Yeah. In order to have a good output. We are all passionate people, but and we work hard, I would say, I guess. And that doesn't mean we have to be serious all the time.
Yeah.
Then I don't think my productivity will be good at all.
Yeah.
I love people that I work with, and I want to work with the people that I get on with.
Yeah.
All our consultants, like structural engineers or lighting designers or quantity surveyors, I love going out having drinking with them. It's just, you know, they're just a nice bunch of people.
Yeah.
It
makes such a difference though, doesn't it? There's nothing more annoying than working with a team of people. I just mean like consultants who, not even are horrible, they're just not that into it. You know, they're not that enthusiastic and you're just like,
You need to drum it up.
Yeah.
You need to drum it up.
But I think it's, I can totally see the appeal of it. And I think the idea that if you've got to work 12, 14 hours a day, it's got to be something you're excited and passionate about, isn't it?
But I think it's like any relationship. If you want to have a close relationship, you need to step forward first.
Mm.
If both are waiting, it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
You know? So, I don't know. I think I say this quite a lot. It's getting quite boring. I mean, if you want something, go for it.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Don't just sit down and be, you know, grumbling about it. Just be realistic and try to understand what you're thinking.
Mm.
Because often we dream and what we want and what we need, desire, is far beyond than what you can actually achieve.
So talking of going out and getting it, what's next for Studio Eve? Like, I spoke to this guy on a plane and he was a business development manager and he randomly started talking to me and I spoke to him about architecture.
Mm.
And he was like, do you know what? He was from Canada, and he was saying that I've spoken to architects and they never have a 5-year plan and it drives him insane. And I was just like, you can have a 5-year plan, but I don't think there's no logic to how you get more work in. It seems to, on a small scale, you know, if you were to have a 5-year plan.
I do have a five-year plan.
Go on.
I actually have a 10-year plan.
Well, this is perfect.
What's... No, I'm not saying. I'm not telling you.
Is it locked in a safe? And if you achieve it, you'll be like, see, I told you I'd have a 10-year plan.
No, I think it's not about that. It's not about having the goal like, oh, in 10 years' time, I want to have 300 employees and have built, you know, I don't know, £500 million worth of building. It's not quantitative goal. It's more like, you know, the what kind of organization that I would like to be involved in and how I could contribute in a certain aspect of life or to the society.
So yours is a more personal development plan in your head. This is what I this is if I get to this point in 5 years, I'll be very happy. Yeah. Not money and not scale, but just from a personal point of view. I guess you want
to... Well, I mean, it's always going to be. Now, I mean, there is a business plan about the company, obviously. You know, there is a flows and things, but that will progress naturally with the designing the organization and how it works. So I don't know. And I mean, yeah, I have a plotted like traditional model of a capital trajectory of like revenues and things. Yeah, that's this is one of the tools, certainly.
They're kind of project targets, you know. Oh, do you know what we'd love to do? And then a project that, you know, I know Make would love to do a cultural, like a museum or a gallery or something.
Yeah.
So that's what we're focusing on over the next 5 years. And I was wondering, what type of things do you want Studio Weave, or are you working on them now and they're going to come to fruition in a couple of years or 5 years' time? Or
housing.
Yeah.
Housing. Myself, personally interested in where people spend a lot of time and where we form our relationship. So I have a great passion for office buildings and houses and housings and public spaces. But, you know, that doesn't mean that we're not interested in the galleries or other things, but that's not just a singular sector that we're thinking. It's more of a how it embeds itself to its surroundings. Yeah. That's what interests me and quite a lot of us, that what it means to have a gallery in this location and at this time is far more important than just simply the volumetric understanding of the gallery.
Yeah.
It's a big part, but what does this mean to this place?
Yeah.
You know?
I am going over to Assemble Studios, and they've built the Yard House or Sugar House, the rentable office space, and then also coming here and seeing this kind of rentable like studio space. And then David Batchelor's, he's just gone to a new one, and it's just really interesting. You know, you go down these corridors and when the doors are open, you can see and you've got like art studio, gallery space, architect, designer, and they're just such amazing places. But you look at them from the outside and, you know, they're just like an old warehouse or something. And I think, yeah, I can totally see why kind of office space in that mindset becomes a really interesting typology. Like when you said we want to work in houses, and I thought for a split second you're going to go, because the money would be great, and then you went, because of the kind of, that's where people connect and that's where people spend most of their time. And such a nice, you know, if you do a house that people love, that's like the...
You know, it's like we are working on really big housing project at the moment, which is 100% social rent. We will always be that type of organization. Yeah. Whatever money comes in, we'll spend it on resource, because we won't be just looking at the singular method of doing things. We will be looking at, you know, why something doesn't work. Why do we have problem? We spend a lot of time finessing.
Yeah.
Because
the story side of things, right? Mm. You know, we're going full circle back to the original thing. That's... that's like another work stream. If it's a lot of work to prove and create a story, and that's, I don't know, like it's a lot of work, isn't it? Additional work. And I think the amount of hours that you put in for the amount of hours that you charge out, they're never going to stack up. And I always think, you know, the second you start chasing money as a primary function, and you try and break down, okay, how much are we spending? What are we doing that's taking up all our hours? How can we make it more efficient? It's the second you lose all the kind of nice and fun parts that you started for, which is why you do have to be passionate about what you're doing to spend 12, 14-hour days.
Oh, no. People in our office turn up at 9:30. They pretty much all go home before 7:00.
That's awesome.
I really dislike the long hour working. No.
That's awesome to hear.
No, I mean, yeah. It's tragic that sometime that have to happen, but you know, when you're having fun, yeah, you can work late.
Yeah.
But
and G&T's obviously.
Yeah. Keeps I mean, office, but obviously. You know, no, be productive while you're working and go home.
Mm.
Have life.
So, if any part ones listening to this, are you guys hiring at all?
Actually, we might be hiring.
There you go, part ones. He's hiring.
Oh, we actually generally don't hire part ones.
Scratch that. Fail.
No, I mean, but it doesn't really matter which stage of life they're in. But if you value yourself, your value judgment is about your wages.
Mm.
We're definitely not it.
Yeah.
But we are interested in interesting people that who want to do things, but being analytical to themselves and who can apply themselves into the world. We get a lot of CVs, and let's face it, a lot of them are, it's just not quite a right fit.
Yeah. Also, because you're all in one room, you know, there's nowhere to hide. If you don't get on with someone, you don't get on with someone. I think as personality plays such a big part in an interview. I guess when you're interviewing someone, you know, you've made up your mind relatively quickly. They're just not going to fit in, are they? I
think they need to be quite relaxed. If you take yourself too seriously, that's just not going
to
work.
Yeah. It's we're coming up to the hour mark, so I've taken up loads of your time, so I'll wrap this up. But I was just, it's interesting you said about personality and how you employ people, because when I first said I was going to work at Make, I was talking to a tutor at Nottingham, and she went, you know what, you'd fit in really well at Make, because she used to, what's it called, send people to go to different practices, I've completely forgotten the name. Anyway, this idea that personalities is just as important as your grades, I'd not really factored in to, and it's, I think it's so important what you're saying. You're excited to come to work. You're excited about the group of people you've got. And if you take yourself way too seriously, you may get the best grades at the Bartlett or Westminster and win the first prize of the year. But no one's going to want to work with you unless you start your own practice. And then I guess you can do whatever you want. But
no, you can never do what you want in that context. I mean, but I don't know. I mean, Just people need to learn how to let your hair down and just, you know, to look at yourself. You can be critical to yourself. I think we should all do that. You can look at yourself as critically as you can and then drink a couple of G&T and get over it.
I think that's the key. I think we'll wrap up there and just say, if in doubt, have a gin and tonic and just chill out.
Well, yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it's
such a nice day.
I know, 24 degrees C. What? What are we doing in this bloody meeting room and not outside drinking G&T? What time is this? 10 o'clock in the morning?
It's 9 minutes past drinking time.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Jay. That's been really good.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, I really hope you enjoyed that. That was episode number 3 of the Create More podcast with Jay from Studio Eve. Yeah, that was fun. That was the first kind of new setup for me, because that was I'd not actually met Jay before. So this was the first kind of podcast I'd done where I didn't know the person, or I had not met the person before I did the interview. So I got to the studios in Dalston and could not find the address. And then just around the corner, you know, Jay rocks up all chilled out in flip-flops and his hair blowing in the breeze. And I'm like, Jay, he's like, Ben, and go in, sit down. And we had a few phone call interruptions at the beginning, and you suddenly realise as a director of a studio, he's got quite a lot of phone calls coming in. So had a few missed starts at the beginning, but then then we really got into it, and then by the end we were both talking about our mutual love of G&Ts. So it was really good fun, and so I really like their website, and I really like their projects. And the great thing about the podcast is I get to review and go through all of their podcasts for the images for Acast and stuff. So it gives me such a good insight. So I hope that you're listening to this on Acast, and if you are, I hope that you're looking at the images, because I think they really make a difference. I don't know, I keep banging on about it, but I put a lot of effort into it. So just shut up and enjoy it. I don't know if you noticed, they talked about Zero Zero at the beginning. That's an architecture practice they're kind of collaborating with, and another people I'd really like to get on there on this podcast, which I'm kind of hoping to get in contact with him through Jay, is Alistair Parvin from Zero Zero, who did a really interesting TED talk about the Wiki House. So that is one that I'm just telling you, I'm slowly trying to secretly get an interview locked in for the next month or so. But episode number 4. What's this? So, 1, 2, 3. So, yeah, episode number 4 will be with Jason Bruges, who is just an amazing, they're an amazing studio that does really cool installation architecture, and they're interactive installations, and they interact with people as they walk past. And when I did my dissertation, I was obsessed with this practice. And I mean, they've worked with. They've just done they're one of their latest projects. They've done Double Digital, which is a kind of interactive door on the number 10 on Downing Street. They've worked with Channel 4, they've worked with Dyson, they've worked with Aston Martin. And go to jasonbruges.com and check out the website, because it is amazing. And so I'm going to sit down with them tomorrow, and then that will come out in a couple of weeks. So I really hope you enjoyed that. And I will, the next podcast out in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.